Yes, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. And I was listening to several talks related to, let's say, strongly interacting fermions. I will do differently compared to other people, and maybe it will also be useful, especially for young people, to give a little bit of a historical introduction to the subject. Yes, and the thing is that here is the outline of my talk. It's written who I am. And I will discuss the BCS-BEC crossover shortly, then I will discuss molecular BEC regime, and then I will turn to novel subject of Fermi-Fermi mixtures, mixtures of different fermionic systems, what kind of novel phases we expect there. But before I do all this, I have 45 minutes or?
No, you have from 1 hour to 1 hour 30 minutes.
Oh, don't give me too much time, you know.
But after 1 hour, people are allowed to leave. So if it's protracted,
yes, good. Good. You know, so the story of these fermions started actually 10 years ago or something like that, in 1997 or 96 even. And the question that people raised was the following, that already in 95, people obtained the first Bose-Einstein condensates, rubidium, lithium, sodium, and the Nobel Prize has been given in 2001 to Eric Cornell, Wolfgang Ketterle, Carl Wieman. And what people ask themselves is, since we already observed this BEC, nice excitation pictures, nice evolutions, collapses, interference of condensates, and very many other interesting things, do we expect interesting macroscopic quantum phenomenon in the case of ultra-cold Fermi gases? This question was a little bit naive, yes, and we know from textbooks that we can expect interesting quantum phenomena, but what happened is the following. Very simple picture follows here, yes, and do I have a pointer somewhere or I don't? Okay, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Okay, good. That, you know, what people use in these experiments is an external trapping potential based on the Zeeman energy or optical fields. And let's say they store two component Fermi gas. Let me call them blue fermions and green fermions. People from condensed matter physics may think as this is spin up and spin down particles. In real life, these are two different hyperfine states, internal states of an atom. Yes. Then we all know that due to Pauli principle, only one blue fermion can be on a given energy level, also only one green. They fill in all energy states up to the Fermi energy at zero temperature. The distribution function is like that. At the finite temperature, it's a little bit smooth. And then, you know, if I recalculate the Fermi energy through the number of particles in the trap and the trap frequency, and this is the Fermi momentum, which is density in the power one-third, then I get that the Fermi energy is number of particles in the power one-third multiplied the trap frequency. Then we all know, because we read books, that if, let's say, blue and green fermions attract each other, and I consider the case of very low energies, only S-wave scattering between particles is efficient. So blue fermions do not interact with blue, green do not interact with green, only greens interact with blue. Yes. Then, in this weakly interacting gas, and the parameter is Na cubed much smaller than 1, where A is the characteristic radius of interaction or scattering length, or K Fermi A much smaller than 1. For attractive interaction between the guys, they undergo Cooper pairing at sufficiently low temperature, so form strongly correlated pairs near with momenta near the Fermi surface, K and minus K. Yes? And then there is a superfluid transition, which is called Bardeen-Cooper-Schiffer, very well-known transition. And here is the expression for the transition temperature. It's the Fermi energy multiplied exponent in the power minus unit divided by K Fermi A. In the weakly interacting gas, so in solids, Here you have the Debye frequency in a weakly interacting gas. This is the Fermi energy. But here it's unity divided by K Fermi A, the small parameter. So this guy is exponentially small compared to the temperature of quantum degeneracy, compared to the Fermi energy. And realistically, if I substitute all numbers which are in nature for this scattering length, scattering amplitude, I obtain that this transition temperature is much smaller than 0.1 of the Fermi energy. So for ordinary values of A, it's something like below 1 nanokelvin or something like that. So it's out of experimental reach, or at least it's very hard to reach that. And people rather quickly realized that. And then what happened is the following, that they did experiments. And the experiments have been done with two component a system of potassium 40 and with two component system of lithium 6. It has been done in the dilute limit, which means that the mean interparticle separation was much larger than the characteristic radius of interaction between particles. In the ultra cold limit, where the de Broglie wavelength was much larger than this interaction radius, only S wave scattering is important, just what I said. And in 1998, the group of Deborah Jean reached the quantum degeneracy in the experiments with potassium 40. It was the first quantum degenerate Fermi gas 9 years ago. Yes, and then, of course, after that, many other people have done that, reached quantum degeneracy, and so on. And I would like to say here, this is a political line or two lines. Why political? Because it lists all experimental groups which have reached quantum degeneracy with fermions. And why some of them are blue and some of them are brown, it's very simple. The blue guys deal with potassium and the brown guys with lithium. This is the only difference. So, I would like to say here that densities that we are talking about are 10 to the 13th, 10 to the 14th particles per cubic centimeter. And for people who are new people in the field or comparatively new people for the field, it's important to understand that these are extremely low densities by 8 or even 9 orders of magnitude smaller than in liquid helium 3. And temperatures that we are dealing with are of the order of 1 microkelvin or lower, again, a few orders of magnitude lower than in the case of helium-3. So it's an extremely dilute and cold system. And I would like to mention here about the temperatures, that in the case of fermions, in contrast to bosons, there is the so-called phenomenon of Pauli blocking. What people do, how people obtain Bose-Einstein condensates, it's very simple. What you do, you trap particles in a magnetic trap by certain means, and then what you start doing, you lower the trap barrier. High energy particles escape, low energy particles remain there, they collide with each other, equilibrate, and then you lose both particles and energy, but you lose energy more than particles because high energy particles escape, and in this way you decrease the temperature. For bosons, this process, which is called evaporative cooling, works very efficiently, and presently, the official world record in cooling bosons is 550 picokelvin. It belongs to Wolfgang Ketterle. It is done in a slightly different way using the adiabatic expansion, but it's there. Very low density, 10 to 10, 10 to 11 particles per cubic centimeter and temperature 550 picokelvin. There are unofficial records which are not yet recognized officially. And those are something like 50 picokelvin, or even slightly lower.
Huh? Who is the official?
Oh, official Ketterle.
He recognizes his own results.
Yes, but, well, you know, the thing is that his results are very convincing. It's clear that they have this temperature. In other experiments, it's quite likely that they do, but still there are some questions.
How
yes.
Does he get the temperature?
Yes, what you can do, if you have a Bose-condensed gas at a certain temperature, what you can do, you can measure the density profile, yes? You can do it in situ sometimes in a trap, but what people mostly do, they switch off the trap, the gas expands, becomes larger. Then you take a photo camera, make a picture. Usually your photo camera is a probing laser, and you get the density profile. And from the shape of the density profile, you derive the temperature. And there are limitations, of course, because if the temperature is extremely low, you cannot do that. But in the case of fermions, there is the so-called Pauli blocking. The rate of evaporative cooling is proportional to the rate of elastic collisions, because high energy particles escape, low energy particles remain, and they have to equilibrate to lower temperature. They can only do that due to collisions. But if my temperature is already much lower than the Fermi energy, then all energy states below the Fermi surface, almost all of them, are already occupied. And when two particles collide, they cannot enter one of these states. Yes? So they can, but there is a strong reduction. This is called Pauli blocking. This Pauli blocking reduces the rate of elastic collisions and reduces the rate of evaporative cooling. So there are severe limitations to cool fermions. And actually what now people can do experimentally, I mean, there are very many theoretical calculations. I better refer to experiments. They can cool to temperatures of the order of 0.1 Fermi energy, maybe 0.05, but not lower. Something like that. And this is a severe limitation which does not allow people in experiments to reach the BCS limit. Because look here, this guy is extremely small, and what stands here is something like 10 to minus 2 of the Fermi energy, or 0.02 Fermi energy at least. And there is a strong difficulty to reach the interesting BCS limit, about which we know very many things from theory, but experimentally it's... So if someone has a bright idea how one can cool fermions to extremely low temperatures and circumvent this Pauli blocking, you are quite welcome. Yes? So...
It can be evaporative cooling, it should be something else.
Yes, something else.
Sorry?
You mean sympathetic cooling when you add boson? Well, people did some calculations, because imagine, please, that you add bosons to the system, but particles still collide, but fermions, which are supposed to be cooled, they still undergo Pauli blocking, because if the temperature is much smaller than the Fermi energy, the fermionic states are almost all occupied. So there are certain limits, and it is a little bit better if I add bosons, yes, then you can cool to somewhat lower temperatures, but not much lower, yes. And people have calculated that. I forgot the number, but it's something what I mentioned, yes. And there should be something else. So one should come up with a more or less revolutionary idea here. So those who have revolutionary ideas are quite welcome, yes? If you see a way of, sorry?
I mean, there is paper by Peter Solomon, which they have this proper cooling, you know, to collect this, which is some type of sympathetic cooling, but it's not, the temperature is not limited by the temperature of the bosons, but actually, because one still evaporative cools the bosons, but actually, the equilibrium temperature can be much, much lower than the temperature of the bosons. So the temperature of the bosons is completely irrelevant for the temperature of the second species.
Yes.
Which allows to cool probably preferable temperatures, just to mention it.
Yes, and there are several other ideas. If I will have time and there will be people interested, I will tell you what they are. But so far, they are not implemented, they don't work, and people say that this is difficult to implement them and so on. But, you know, with all these things in experiments and theory, what we could do around 98-99 was to go home, yes, and saying, okay, we cannot do fermions, but okay. What helped is the nature, the form of Fermbach resonance. The first experimental observation of Fermbach resonances is the one contaminated with sodium chloride. Yes, and it was somewhere around 90% for bosons. And this is simply the dependence of the scattering amplitude or scattering length on the magnetic field. At certain magnetic fields, it turns out to be negative. Here it's small negative, and BCS approach works. Here it's very large, either negative or positive. The approach will shrink back, doesn't work. Here it's positive. Yes. And here I would like to say that I think that all people here in the audience understand what is Feshbach resonance. Do you? Other people who don't know what is Feshbach resonance, please confess. Young people and youth people, tell me. Who needs an explanation of the Feshbach resonance?
Well, you're here by the 12th of February on Feshbach resonances, and it's been
You know, the thing is that let me just give my very simple explanation. You will understand what I will tell you. Imagine that there are two atoms, let's say green and blue. This is the distance between these atoms, and they approach each other along a certain interaction potential. This is the interaction potential between the atoms. They are in certain internal states. Usually we call them hyperfine states in this subject. So this interaction potential, it consists of a van der Waals scale, potential well and repulsive core. You may think of it as left Jones. Then, so they approach each other, but due to hyperfine interactions, it's possible that particles can undergo an anadiabatic transition to a different potential curve in such a way that the internal states of one of the particles or of both of them changes. When the internal state changes, here at large distances, more or less nothing is dramatically changing. Only the potential curve is shifted, the interaction potential, just due to a change of the internal energy. So I put it higher. Then what happens that particles, ultra-cold particles, approach each other with almost zero energy, undergo a non-adiabatic transition to this potential curve. And then if there is a bound state in this Brown curve, which is rather close to the continuum of this curve, then this is the very well-known problem, discrete level on the background of the continuum. There is a resonance. And actually, we call this Feshbach resonance. And in this case, the scattering amplitude, what we do now, we call.
Can I ask you a question? How sensitive is this to the nature of the hyperfine machine?
Yeah. Yes, I will tell you everything now. That's what I was going to do. The thing is that this resonance, the amplitude of hyperfine pairing determines the width of the resonance. Yes, whether it's wide or narrow, depends how here, whether it goes like that or it goes like that, or it goes like that. Yes. And the this we call Feshbach resonance. Actually, equally well, we could call it Fano resonance, because this issue, this discrete level on the background of continuum, it's a theoretical problem, has been introduced by Feshbach in the context of nuclear physics. Ugo Fano did it about the same time in the context of atomic and condensed matter physics. And in cold atom physics, this this term appeared in 1993, has been introduced by Baudouin Ferhar, who has a background in nuclear physics and called it Feshbach resonance. Just happened such. If it were someone from condensed matter or atomic physics, it could be equally well Fano resonance. And in fact, what happens is that if you look here, there's also nothing else than scattering. Two particles approach each other, form a compound system, and then undergo scattering. Yes? So this all can also be treated in terms of scattering. It's interesting that all these great people, first Fano and then Feshbach, they barely refer to Braid and Wigner, don't refer to each other, and okay, these things happen. Yes? But then, so that's what it is. And then it was really a present for experimentalists because, you know, here the scattering length is large. And then, okay, if I look in my BCS formula, then the parameter is approaching unity. Of course, BCS doesn't work, but one can hope to have significantly large transition temperature. So what happened is that people did a lot of interesting experiments here, yes, and but not here, because here, in order to reach the BCS regime, I need very low temperatures. So it's a sort of Parkinson law. Here, about BCS, we know almost everything. We open textbooks. I prefer Landau-Lifshitz, but there are many others. And then to adjust the existing theory to the presence of an external trapping potential is not a great deal. Well, if there are people here who did it before, please excuse me. But, you know, this has been done, of course. But here, where the approach of weakly interacting gas doesn't work because K Fermi A is of order 1 or even much larger than 1, we can do very little theoretically. Monte Carlo people are extremely angry with me when I say those words. Because, you know, in this sense, I am saying that Monte Carlo work is not exactly theoretical physics. I'm sorry, yes, but, you know, here, you know, if you want to have quantitative results, the only way is to do the Monte Carlo approach, yes? So, and, of course, people did some kind of, let's say, try to do some scaling theories here and so on, and some other things, but to get quantitative results, so far, until recently, most quantitative results have been obtained by Monte Carlo. So, and then what happens here if the scattering length is positive? You know, if I still consider an atomic gas, then nothing happens because an atomic Fermi gas with repulsive interaction doesn't undergo a superfluid transition. But what happens here is that for large and positive scattering length, green and blue fermions can form a weakly bound state. Yes? And I will consider the case of a wide resonance where this, where the width of the resonance is much larger than Fermi energy, also larger than this epsilon zero. So I will skip this two-channel problem. It's a single-channel problem. Just think that your interaction potential is such that there is a large scattering length. Here it's large and positive, and then two fermions, green and blue, form weakly bound states. You know, I am usually questioned on the subject. Why? How comes? And this is a very interesting question. You know, it's on quantum mechanics. You know, here, the scattering length is large and positive. So what it means is two atoms in the mean field strongly repel each other. At the same time, I'm talking about weakly bound states of those atoms. Why and how? Let's solve a very simple quantum mechanical problem. Let us imagine that there is a force center in the form of a potential wall, yes, and there is an incident particle with an extremely low energy. Yes. Question, does this potential wall repel this particle or attract this particle? And the answer is, it can be both. It can be both. The answer depends on where is the last bound state. In the three-dimensional case, it happens such that if there is a weakly bound state in the potential well, then the interaction amplitude of this ultra-cold particle with this force center corresponds to a strong repulsion. Yes, it's the three-dimensional. In 1D, it's the other way around. Yes, exactly. 1D and 3D in this case are drastically different. In the three-dimensional case, it's a little bit counterintuitive. You know, for ultra-cold particles, The ultra cold particle is strongly repelled by this force center, but at the same time, there is a weakly bound state. And this is the nature of those bound states here.
Sorry? How weakly should it be bound? Suppose I make it deeper.
Yes, the thing is that the characteristic length of this bound state, the extension of the wave function, you know, the answer becomes unknown, or at least this repulsion can go to attraction when this extension of the wave function becomes of the order of the radius of this potential well. Yes, if the extension of the wave function is much larger than this radius of the potential well, then it's very nice strong repulsion. So that's what. Yes.
But it's sort of resonance bound.
Yes.
And but unbound, and that's the case where it's attractive.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. True. Okay. So let me continue here. Again, with these arguments, I will present here. You know. That we see as being a crossover, very well-known phenomena. Here, if I change the magnetic field, let's say from here to there, then in these fields, the scattering length is small and negative, BCS, transition temperature divided by the Fermi energy, small. Here is the strongly interacting region. The two lines here, they simply indicate that I don't know what really the transition temperature is. Here, I have these bound pairs of fermions. So fermions from bound states, these are composite bosons. And when the size of a composite boson is much smaller than the distance between them, I am supposed to get Bose-Einstein condensation of those guys. And there is the BEC temperature for an ideal gas of these weakly bound molecules. Yes, it's here. In terms of Fermi energy, it's 0.2 of the Fermi energy for the atom. So I have this strongly interacting regime, BCS regime, and this molecule. And a similar picture has been introduced by people in condensed metaphysics long time ago. And I'm here a little bit wrong, because actually I should probably first quote the work of Keldysh with excitons in the 60s, then the work of Eagles, yes, and then Tony Leggett, Schmidt. And also people who worked let's say, 2D helium-3 films, they just had the same picture, yes? So, may I skip the strongly interacting regime, because otherwise it takes a lot of time. What people have done, let me still get this. They have investigated the strongly interacting regime, and Monte Carlo study, they just obtained what is the chemical potential. It's roughly speaking 0.4 of the Fermi energy. What is the transition temperature? I here quote, you must Prokofiev, Svistunov. There are some results which are somewhat different, range to 0.23. People are now doing a lot of things regarding that nature of superfluid pairing, transition temperature, excitations, etc. And there were very many experiments with this strongly interacting regime. Why? It's an interesting system, because if K Fermi model, say, much larger than 1, then there is only one distance scale, mean interparticle separation, only one energy scale, Fermi energy, and there is a universal thermodynamics. Actually, Jason Ho wrote a very nice paper a few years ago saying that what is absent in this paper are the numbers. And then, in order to prove a superfluid nature, what people have done, they obtained what in rotating strongly these are at different values of the scattering length. I'm here, 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 and here. In all four pictures, I'm in the strongly interacting regime. Yes, and then these vortices, they are seen as holes, dark spots in the density profile, which has been made by absorptive imaging, making a photo of the system. It was a direct proof of superfluidity. People now have very interesting experiments with imperfect gases. I will now turn to this.
Can I just ask you, ask, this is a really naive question. How ironclad is that?
Sorry?
The fact that you have vortices?
Ah, okay. You do the following. For example, imagine that you have a vortex, yes? Then you have a hole in the density profile, isn't it? And the characteristic size of this hole in the density profile, in the strongly interacting regime at least, then what happens is that the size of this hole is of the order of the correlation, and it is small. So if you try to make the measurement in situ in the trap, you don't see this hole. Then what you do, you switch off your tripping potential, your cloud expands, and also the this hole expands, the size of this hole becomes larger and larger. And then what you do, you come with your photo camera, make a picture with your probing laser, you measure the density of the system, and you see this hole.
Yeah, I think my question wasn't about intelligence. I was simply asking, the fact that you actually see vortices, how strong a proof is that, that you actually have?
It's a very interesting question. What people say is that it's a direct proof of superfluidity.
Yeah, you said that.
So that's what I can say, because can you imagine to have really quantum vortices, moreover, vortex lattice, if you are not super?
Well, I think there was a few talks ago, somebody just
measure the velocity field is extremely difficult, yes? But what you can do here is to say that quantized vortices, they form the vortex lattice and so on. Then what you can also do, you can measure the coherence, yes, by interference experiments. Yes? That's what they have not yet done, but are doing, yes?
Okay.
Yes. So to measure the velocity field, yes, to measure the circulation, it's very simple. Well, it also can be done. One can also try to measure that. Then that's what Mahid said. It's just quantized vortices. Yes.
Well, if you rotate it faster, you get more vortices. It's not quantitative. It's not.
Yeah.
It's qualitatively consistent with quantum.
So I'm not a classical liquid person, but if you rotate the classical liquid faster, you get more or more.
You know,
the fact that it's broken up into this fine filamentary structure.
Eventually, you have to do a quantitative.
Yes, of course. But you know, similar questions people from classical liquids ask, yes, and they're all the time saying that, well, we have to see this velocity field measurement experiment and so on. I think that now, arguments of people who say that this regime is superfluid is rather convincing. They just see vortex lattices and so on, but okay, that's what it is. And let me now turn to this molecular regime where the scattering length is positive, blue and green fermions form bound states. This is a composite bosons. So I have a guess, when this scattering length and the size of this composite boson is just the atom-atom scattering length, in these experiments the scattering length is about 500, 1000, 2000, 3000 angstroms. And if this guy is much smaller than the distance between these molecules, or dimers if you wish, then I have a weakly interacting Bose gas of molecules. And so that's what is written here. Then, what I can do, I can calculate the interaction energy in the system. It's the number of pairs, n is the number of molecules, multiply the interaction energy in a pair. And the interaction energy in a pair is the interaction constant divided by the volume. What this interaction constant is the question here, just because if G is negative, I expect a collapse of a Bose-Einstein condensate of those molecules. If G is larger than zero, I have a stable BEC. So here, let me mention that the fact that I have a weakly interacting Bose gas. In order to calculate the interaction energy, I have to calculate the interaction between two molecules. So I reduce the many-body problem to so-called few-body problem. Because if I know the interaction between two molecules, I know this constant G, then I know the interaction energy in this system. And that's what I have to do.
State of two molecules. In that case, is it stable or will it be a collapse?
Yeah, it's the same question that people ask in the case of atoms. Yes. And imagine please that you create those molecules. Yes? And in principle, two molecules can form a bound state. Then, this bound state has low energy, therefore there should be someone who takes this binding energy away. And then what is supposed to happen is that three molecules have to collide with each other. Two of them form a bound state and the third one carries away the binding energy. At low density, this process is suppressed because it requires three molecules to approach each other to short distances. This is the same reason why we have Bose-Einstein condensates of the atoms. Yes. Do you know that all people who talk about Bose-Einstein condensates, that this is the ground state of the system, they are lying? And they are lying for a very simple reason, that the interaction potential between two atoms, think of it as Leonard Jones, van der Waals tail, potential well repulsive core. And in fact, for alkaline atoms like sodium, rubidium, there are very many bound states here. Yes. So what happens is that we prepare atoms with very low energies, and then they live in the system from Bose-Einstein condensate. But in principle, they can also go to these bound states, to particles. But this requires three-body collisions, and the rate of these three-body collisions at low density is suppressed because it's proportional. The inverse lifetime is proportional to density in the square. And this is the reason why, when we are talking about these Bose or Fermi gases, we do not consider large densities. You know, densities at which the three-body process with molecules or with atoms is not important. It's something like 10 to the 13th, 10 to the 14th particles per cubic centimeter, not more than 10 to the 15th. At larger densities, this three-body process becomes important. Instead of getting a very nice Bose-Einstein condensate, I get these terrible bound states. Yes, and then this is the decay of the system, because three-body recombination leads to an energy release, particles acquire high kinetic energy and go away, escape from the trap. So this is the same reason why we have atomic Bose-Einstein condensate at lower density. But we cannot increase the density, we cannot make it very high. 10 to the 15 is actually the limit. So that's what is happening. So then, let me continue. Yes. So we have to solve the four-body problem, interaction between two molecules. Yes, and then just the exact solution of this problem directly is quite difficult, because what makes four particles, 12 variables in 3D, minus three variables, three coordinates of the center of mass, nine variables, Schrödinger equation with nine variables, it's a bit difficult. But what helps here is the so-called zero-range approximation, or the Bethe-Pyrrhus approach, which comes from Bethe and Pyrrhus from 1935. You know, my talk clearly shows that I'm getting old. I'm making historical remarks. So, what Bethe and Pyrrhus did, they say, okay, they consider two particles, and they say, okay, let us imagine that we're not interested in this short-range physics, what is happening here. We're only interested at distances over here when the relative motion of particles is free. Therefore, what we do, we replace the interaction potential by the boundary. And then when two particles, let's say blue and green, approach each other, in the case of two particles, the wave function behaves itself, unity divided by the distance minus unity divided by the scattering length. This is already somewhere here where the interaction potential is no longer important. So this is especially interesting for the case where the scattering length is large, it is much larger than the characteristic range of this potential. Yes? So then, you know, I can do something similar in the case of four particles. Again, when two guys approach each other, sit on top of each other, the wave function is again the same Bethe-Pirès expression, by a certain function f, which depends on the distance r2 and on the distance between centers of the molecules. Then from the Schrödinger equation, ordinary one, I can obtain an integral equation for the function f, which for translational momenta tending to zero, the S wave scattering dominates, and this function f depends on three variables. This distance r, and the angle between these. That's it. Then, what I will do, knowing that at large separations between the molecules, the wave function is a product of two molecular bound states, and the weakly bound state wave function is like that. Extra r should be here. Multiply unity minus a dimer dimer, a molecule molecule divided by the distance. This is the molecule molecule scattering length. And then I can solve the integral equation and then obtain the molecule molecule scattering length points. It's somewhat different from the old answer present in literature. Yes, but it's also positive, which says that it's quite nice. Yes, because the molecules repel each other, they don't collapse, but Einstein condensate is stable. So compared to the existing result, which was present in many papers, this guy gives, let's say, an order of magnitude smaller collision rate, gives somewhat different sound velocity, and so on. And this result has been reproduced by Monte Carlo calculations of Virginia Astrakhartchik. It has been reproduced by the diagrammatic approach by Max Kagan and his group and Victor Gulari and his group in these years. Yes. So then I would say that okay, one remark that you know this is a three-dimensional case. Because this answer, it's more or less like Born approximation. Imagine, please, that you have two particles. This is my green fermion, this is my blue fermion. So this green interacts with this green with this blue. One plus one. Sorry. But what is interesting is that this answer, that the interaction between the molecules is twice the atom-atom guy, it turns out to be quite good in the two-dimensional case. Yes, in the two-dimensional case, we did the same calculations. Yes, and then, you know, the S-wave scattering in 2D, the characteristic length coming from the interaction potential is sitting under logarithm. Therefore, if you improve it drastically by an order of magnitude or by a factor of 5, it's under logarithm. And if someone is under logarithm, it's not that important. Then, if I compare in realistic conditions the old result which Mohit and other people were using in the two-dimensional case, then I see that the correction is 10%, 25%. So it's not factor 10, not even factor 2 in the two-dimensional case. In 3D, the situation is different. And we also did it in 1D. You know, in 1D, the result of our approach coincides with what follows from this Michel Godin result, equations for this exactly solvable problem. But here I would like to be honest. Do you know who first introduced this function? This is not us. You know, in 1950s, there was a pronounced activity in nuclear physics where people were measuring and then calculating the scattering of a neutron from a deuteron. Deuteron is a bound state. In terms of nuclear physics energies, there is a weakly bound state. Yes, and then the problem becomes similar to the scattering of an atom from the molecule. Yes. Then this problem has been solved in 1956, I think, by Skornyakov and Termar Terasyan during their discussions with Landau. And Landau was the one who, for the three-body system, proposed to modify this Bethe-Pirès boundary condition. In this case, this function was depending on only one distance, so just one-dimensional equation. Then, they did it differently, Skornikov and Per Martirosyan. They did it in the space, but it doesn't matter. The three-body problem has been solved almost 50 years ago, 48, 47 years ago. And in their paper, which is published in JET, by the way, if you have a problem with inventing interesting physics, look in all the Russian literature. It's really a gold mine. Yes. Oh, but it is translated by Americans, by the American Physical Society. American Physical Society does intelligently everything for you. Don't worry. Yes, and then, so that's what has been done in nuclear physics. And what they obtain, by the way, in there, you know, in the case of atom molecule scattering, one may think, green fermion interacts with the molecule consisting of green and blue. Then this guy interacts with this, it's 1A. In practice, it turns out that it's 1.2. This is the result of Skornikov and Martirosyan. Yes? So, okay. So that's what it is. You know, the calculation shows that if the masses of fermionic atoms are equal, then the four-body bound states are absent. Weakly bound four-body states.
So here we have a repulsive scattering that without
four-body. Yes, without four-body. And also three-body bound states are absent for equal masses of fermions. And this actually, I understand why you are asking me this question, because there is a very well-known question in nuclear physics, also in atomic physics, whether we can ever observe the so-called Yefimov states. The question is that, imagine that two particles are characterized by a very large scattering length. Then, Yefimov, 30 and something years ago, made the conclusion that in this case, there are very many weakly bound states for three-body systems. And here, these states are called Yefimov states. And I will not discuss the interesting properties that are well known in the case of bosons. But the same person, Yefimov, told us in 1973 or 74 that in the case of equal mass fermions for three-body problem, these states do not exist. And for the case of fermions, we need equal mass. But what we did in those calculations, we concluded that also four body bound states are absent. Yes. But, you know, all this is quite interesting and the exact result is important. But what was the most counterintuitive from the beginning? Everybody here, we discussed the UCSBC crossover. And we don't care more or less. We just used these many theories and so on. We did a lot of interesting calculations, and we forget that what we are talking about, that these weakly bound dimers, or weakly bound molecules that are formed, these are the highest raw vibrational states of a diatomic molecule. The term raw vibrational here means rotational and vibrational. So, and there are very many deep bound states below. So what we forget that once I form such a weakly bound state, colliding with other particles in the system, for example, this molecule, one molecule can undergo a transition to a deep bound state and another one gets dissociated. You get a high energy release of particles escape from the system. And then what is also known from experiments, and the experiments have been done, for example, for weakly bound molecules of bosonic energy, that the lifetime, it was 100 milliseconds for 10 to 11 density, which is 1 millisecond for 10 to the 13th, is very short. This process is very efficient. And when people came up with this 0.6 and all these things and so on, what molecular physicists said, they said, this is ridiculous. You know? There is a chemical relaxation. Oh. You know, the thing is that nuclear physicists said, well, yes, nuclear physics, books like that, thick, read these books and then come back. The condensed matter physicists were the most gentle. They said, well, you know, you have done a lot of work, you have to make some architectural. Yes, that was the story. But here, you know, the molecular physicists were absolutely right. That's what is happening in the case of molecules consisting of bosonic atoms. What is now here important to understand? Why Russian history is happening? Why did look, let me make a very simple physical picture which shows this. Let me consider a molecule which consists of green and blue fermion, and it collides with a green guy. Then, the weakly bound dimer state that I am considering, I sometimes call weakly bound molecule, sometimes I say dimer, it's, please be aware that it's one and the same thing, is of the order of A. So it's large, it's atom-atom scattering length, which is 1,000, 2,000 angstrom. The size of a deep bound state to which the this molecule can collapse is much smaller. It's something like 50 angstrom. It's a characteristic radius of interaction. It's much smaller than A. But then what happens? In order to undergo this process of relaxation to a deep bound state, all of the three fermions have to approach each other to this short distance, RC. But two of them, in this case green and green, are identical fermions. And as we know from the Pauli principle, identical fermions do not like to approach each other. The corresponding correlation function is a product of their momentum multiplied the distance in the power of 2. I put here question mark due to a 3-part nature of the system. Therefore, the relaxation probability is also proportional to this quantity, the momentum of fermions multiply the distance Re in the power of 2 with a question mark. What is the characteristic momentum of fermions in this problem? The momentum of translational motion, I assume it's tending to zero, very low temperatures. And then it's nothing else than the inverse size of the molecule. The size of the molecule, A, the inverse size is unit divided by A. I substitute K factor is unit divided by A. So it's Re divided by A to the power 2 with a question mark. And this ratio already is something like 1 divided by 20, 1 divided by 100 even. So in the square, it's something like 3 or 4 orders of magnitude. So this says molecules consisting of fermion atoms, quite different compared to the molecules of bosonic atoms. And then when I consider two molecules, I can reduce it to the previous picture, assuming that one of the atoms of this molecule approaches this one, and then I restore the picture that I explained. In practice, it's a little bit more complicated, but okay, let's not discuss that. And then I can write down the relaxation rate, and then it turns out that the power here is not 2, it's 2.55, Re divided by A in the power, 2.55. And then, what is happening here, I restored the dimensions, but I don't know the numerical constant. I only know how the relaxation rate depends on this A. So in order to get the amplitude, this short-range physics, I only consider here. And this is the business of molecular physicists. They say that this is very important. I say that it's not very important, but okay, it's a matter of taste, yes? This C is of order 1, let's say from point 1 to 10, yes? And, right, so then if I calculate tau, the lifetime, which is inversely proportional to this guy, or to this rate and density, it turns out to be seconds or even larger, depends on density. And what is interesting that Rudy Grimm, at density between 10 to 12 and 10 to the 13th particles per cubic centimeter, was obtaining the lifetime. This is very different from the case of bosonic. Look, if these guys are bosons, the Pauli principle is absent. This very nice correlation function, where it is? Okay. And the relaxation probability is proportional to the lifetime of scattering. And the characteristic lifetime at the same time will be of the order of 1 millisecond or even smaller. So, therefore, molecules consist of Fermion atoms. Very, very different from molecules. They are remarkably stable. This is the basic reason why we are still working with this BCSB Sikorsky. If they were not stable, then we could go home already a few years ago. Yes. So their stability is crucial. So what is interesting here, that this stability becomes better. Here I plot the data of Debye gene. Here I'm approaching resonance. This is the rate. And here my theoretical curve, which I adjusted to the existing experimental data in one point. I don't know the numerical constant. That's how it goes. And the reason why this happens, I approach resonance. The molecule becomes larger and larger, becomes weaker and weaker, but it becomes more and more stable. The reason is very, very simple. Look. If the molecule is becoming larger and larger, the characteristic momentum of fermions of the molecule, its reverse size, is becoming smaller and smaller, and the correlation function is becoming smaller. It's more favorable for them to be stable. And I would say, and here I present a comparison of experimental results and theoretical ones. In this case of lithium, I compare our theory with the results of Crystal Salomon in the logarithmic scale. Yes. You know, in the logarithmic scale, the comparison looks so different. And now I would like to say that what do we have with the molecules? We have the situation where there are two things, good things and bad things. Good things are related to elastic collision. The scattering length is large, it's 0.6 atom scattering length, so it's 5,000 amperes or so. Evaporative cooling is very efficient, rate of elastic collisions is good. The relaxation rate is suppressed, it is small. The ratio of bad things, relaxation, to good things, elastic collisions, 10.4. I can do efficient evaporative cooling in both of those molecules. That's what has been done here. So out of atomic cloud in a trap, I get for constant condensation a peak, density peak in the center of the trap. Pictures very well known for atomic Einstein condensates. For people who are new people in the field, why this happens is very simple. Both the Einstein condensate is a macroscopic quantum state. It has no temperature and zero energy. Therefore, the size of this Bose-condensed phase is determined by a balance in between the trapping potential and the repulsive interaction. Whereas here, the size is determined by temperature. So if temperature is much larger than the interaction between particles, then this size of the cloud is much larger than the size of Bose-Einstein condensate. Once I get Bose-condensed, this shallow density grows in the center of the trap. So that's what happened. And so, this was the first molecule for the Einstein condensate obtained so far. And let me tell you that these remarkably stable, highly excited molecules are the largest atoms obtained in the world. Their size is 1,000, 2,000 angstroms, up to 3,000 angstroms. And compared to the diatomic molecules observed before that, the largest diatomic molecules were helium 2 molecules, which you obtain in the nozzle. You obtain helium 3 trimers, helium 2 dimers. Their size was about 100 angstroms. So those guys are much, much larger. So they are just a little bit more, and they will be visible by eye. So, yes. Very interesting. Maybe this is possible. Yes. And these remarkable experiments have been done, let's say, a few years ago. They started in 2003, 2004, 2005. They're continuing now. Yes. But what happens with me is the following: that in the presence of questions and so on, I actually was not able to discuss the last part, which are novel results for Fermi-Fermi mixtures. Yes, right. Maybe I was talking too much. So, those who are tired of me, yes, are welcome to leave. Yes, those who are not tired of me, I can tell you a few words about Fermi mixtures. Okay, good. After this work, this reporting has been done. Very, very many other people in the world, and they will approve what happens if fermionic atoms, which are present, the two components, Fermi gas is such that the message of transportation. For example, I have a component, lithium 6, and single component of potassium, or single component of lithium, a single component of strontium. So, the physics is similar, but the masses of atoms are different. What happens with collision stability and molecular BEC? Yes? So, again, I would like to say that I will skip here very interesting physics, which is related to the case when these masses are transferable. Yes? Otherwise, I will have to talk 2 or 3 hours. You will definitely not survive. Yes? And I will consider only the case where the masses of fermionic atoms in the mixture are very different. So, I have very heavy atoms with the mass m big, single component, and very light fermions with the mass m small.
You have only a single hyperfine species of each?
Yes,
mass.
Yes, only single hyperfine species. And this is now the case in the experiment of Green. He has single species potassium and single species lithium in one and the same mixture. So what happens if the scattering length is positive, that this guy and this guy form a bound state, it's a molecule, and there is another molecule. Those molecules can be nicely Bose-condensed, theoretically. The question is their stability. In order to understand their stability and their interaction with each other, let us do the problem in the Born approximation. In the Born approximation, what I do, I first notice an analogy with a hydrogen atom. Imagine that this is a proton and this is electron. So it's exactly the hydrogen atom problem, but there is no Coulomb interaction between particles, and the Coulomb interaction between electrons and protons is replaced by the short-range interaction. That's it. Then, in the Born approximation, I can average out the motion of light atoms and calculate the exchange. The exchange interaction, because these are identical fermions, it's like in the hydrogen triplet state. It's like that. Yes? And this is the formula. It's the recoverable formula where A is the same. So, these molecules are characterized by a very strong repulsion. It's a very interesting situation. So, these are hydrogen atoms without Van der Waals interaction. In the case of hydrogen atoms, I have to add here the Van der Waals attraction. It goes like that. But the Van der Waals attraction appears due to the presence of a charge of a proton and the charge of electron. If I remove the charge of a proton and the charge of electron, I exactly get this picture. So, it's a picture of a hydrogen atom in which proton and electron have no charge, and instead of Coulomb have short-range interactions. Yes. But the exchange interaction is repulsive. In order to arrive at low interparticle distances, these particles have undergo tunneling in this potential because they have low energy. And the tunneling probability is exponent to the power of minus 0.9. It was calculated 0.6 before, now it's better. Square root of the mass ratio. So if the mass ratio is very big, then this guy is very small. And those molecules do not approach each other at distances where formation of time, state, whatever. So they are collision state. But what is interesting, in contrast to the molecules I was discussing so far, here the collision stability is independent of the molecule or the atom-atom scattering. It depends on the structure. So this is remark number one. And remark number two is that when people start to everybody was implicitly thinking that we have a gas. You know, we got this experiment with strongly interacting Fermi gas. And all experiments were showing that this is a gas. And that's what everybody was thinking. And this is not true. Look. Very light and very heavy fingers. So these are my heavy guys and these are light guys. By the way, the fact that those guys are fingers is very important here. Then they interact via a cover interaction potential, which is expressed in this way, where R is the distance between the guys. The kinetic energy is this one. It contains the large mass in the denominator. Yes? Then what I can do, I write down the Hamiltonian of many body system as a sum of all potential interactions in the binary approach. By how the binary approach is varied, I will tell you later. And then it can be written such that I separate this constant. And then there is H tilde, which is a function of the scale distance, which is the distance between fermions, heavy fermions divided by the atom-atom scattering length and the mass ratio. Then look here. Let me start increasing the mass ratio. Nothing happens with the interaction energy. It's the Born-Oppenheimer result. And the Born-Oppenheimer result doesn't care how heavy these molecules are. So these heavy fermions are. They can be extremely heavy and nothing happens. But the kinetic energy does. If I increase M, the kinetic energy is decreased. So I have a strong repulsion, which does not change when I increase the mass ratio, and I have a kinetic energy decreasing. And then for sufficiently small kinetic energy to potential energy ratio, I am supposed to form a Wigner crystal. And this is supposed to happen when the critical mass ratio is larger, when the mass ratio is larger than the critical value. It's clear. Particles strongly repel each other. Yes. The gas state assumes that kinetic energy is significant. That's the balance of the kinetic energy. Then, if I make my mass of Pn larger and larger, the kinetic energy is decreasing. And the potential energy of the strongly beats the kinetic energy. So if I then put particles in a box or in a trapping potential in such a way that they don't fly away from each other, then I get the Wigner crystal. Why I call it Wigner crystal phase? Because it's very similar. That's what is happening. Again, I would like to say here that we are not the first people who were considering this type of crystallism. There was an old idea of David Nelson in Tactical Supermarket to model flux by repulsively interacting bosons. Then it turned out that the characteristic interaction potential in that case, they were considering 2D case, was 2D Yukawa. 2D Yukawa is something different from what we have. But then David Sepperle and several other people did calculations and found a crystalline frame. So they worked out the idea of Nelson in a later stage, because Nelson's work is end of 60s, beginning of 70s, and Sepperle was end of 70s. David Sepperle...
probably in high school or school.
Oh, 70s, yes. The work of Sepperle, where he refers to Nelson, the first work of 70s. Yes, 60s, I probably did it as a guess. Yes, right, you are right. Sorry. I don't have a right to make a mistake. Then, you know what we have done? We have done the calculation. Now let us bring it down. Let us assume that the mass ratio of my fermions is larger than the critical value, and I put my system in a box and fix the density. Then, I change the scattering length by increasing the density. Here, the scattering length is small, positive, and becomes larger, larger, larger. Here, it tends to infinity. Then, if the scattering length is small, okay, I have a gas phase, the repulsion is not that strong. Then there is a critical point where I undergo a quantum transition to the crystalline phase. And at this point, by the way, we have calculated that Na cube is still significantly smaller than 1. And this is the first order transition. People who did this this Nelson idea separately et al. They also concluded, at least Gianni Blatter, that this was the first order. Then, what I do, I continue to increase the scattering length, and then the crystalline phase survives. But then, I know that at unitarity, when the scattering length is infinite, my nice exchange repulse is at, it requires a certain final scattering. So what it means is that somewhere here, there will be either another quantum transition to a liquid state, which is different from the state here, or the system will decay due to inelastic processes, trimer formations, or whatever, somewhere here. Here, I put a question mark because I don't know what happens.
I missed your argument.
Oh, the second transition, because here, at this magnitude, my scattering length is infinity. Yes. For an infinite scattering length, this nice exchange repulsion that I was talking about is absent. Yes. Therefore, there should be no crystalline phase.
First, you have actually two transitions.
Yes.
I understand second.
Yes, and the first transition is the following. Assume, please, that your density is very small. Sorry, that your scattering length is very small. Yes. Then, yes. Here, you know, for a very small scattering length, it's weak. Yes, because it drops almost immediately. Yes, and the molecules are small. So they form a gas phase. Then, if I increase the scattering length, I eventually get a crystal when the molecules are stronger. By increasing the scattering length, I somehow increase the exchange repulsion, because the exchange repulsion drops as unit exponent in the power of minus distance divided by the scattering length.
I heard people saying that to have a Wigner crystal, you need to have long-range interactions, such as Coulomb repulsion.
Yes. Yes, you know, I also learned this criticism, yes. But what I did, I looked in the old work of people, Gianni Blatter, and even earlier, David Sepperle, and so on. They sometimes use this term, Wigner crystal, but not very often. So if, you know, why I pronounce this term, Wigner crystal, just to emphasize a sort of analogy with electrons and liquid helium. Actually, if you wish, I can skip this term. That's what I'm telling to people. Saying frankly, I do not know whether I am allowed to call it Wigner crystal. So therefore, we are now writing a paper with people, yes, Dima is the main author, then Grisha Astrahashi, Christoph Salomon, and myself, yes. And we will try, if we use the term Wigner crystal, we use it once or twice, but, you know. Please excuse me, but I don't know whether I am allowed to call it Wigner crystal or not. Sorry? Yes. Yes. Let me tell you that we did analytically the many body problem, and we built the small parameter of the system, which allows to do what I did. It's just on the next transparency. You know, what I did, I was working very hard this morning. I was preparing a dog. So then, you know, this is first. You know, what we first did, we calculated the critical mass ratio, assuming that the motion of heavy atoms is two-dimensional. Then we get triangular lattice, but the critical mass ratio is 200. So, what I then did, I looked in the Mendeleev periodic table, and then it's quite hard to find atoms with the mass ratio of 200. Actually, it's impossible. Even if I take deuterium multiplied by 200, I get someone with the mass 400. Yes. Then, what we also did, we did the many-body problem. It's important, that's what Hans Petter said. And we have revealed that the binary approach that we use assumes this small parameter. It's actually the Green function, much smaller than 1, where R, please think of it as the lattice constant. Yes, and the lattice constant should be somewhat larger than the size of the molecule. Yes. It turns out that it should be not very much larger, but it's sufficient to have here coefficient 2.2. Then this is one term. And we have derivations, and we have to intermix with each other, and then mix them up here. Then, you know, how to obtain this crystalline phase. Then what you can do, because it's interesting to get this crystal, then, and what changes if, you know, this result assumes that light fermions undergo three-dimensional motion. What changes if I restrict the light fermions to 2D motion? So how to obtain this mass ratio? Let's take an optical lattice and put the fermions with a small filling factor. Then, what the optical lattice does, it changes the effective mass. Let us make it such that only heavy atoms fill the optical lattice. So the light atoms are only captured just because they form bound states with heavy guys. So then, if I raise the barrier of the optical lattice, I increase this guy, and then I can increase the mass ratio, yes, and that's what is written. People have analyzed, and there is now an experiment set up by Christoph Salomon, that they can make an optical lattice that potassium atoms fill, but lithium atoms don't. So it's a mixture of lithium-6 and potassium-40, where the bare mass ratio is 6.7. And then, okay, here they can reach the mass ratio comparatively easily of several hundred. And then I get this system. What happens with my crystalline phase, it's just the formation of a super lattice. On top of an optical lattice, I get a super lattice with a significantly larger lattice constant. Yes? Okay, number one escaped. Yes? So, another question. So this is possible, and this is very interesting. Another question, what changes if light fermions undergo 2D motion? Then the interaction here k are decaying Bessel functions, it's different. It's also different from 2D you cover. Then we have done calculations here. Here is the small parameter where kappa is the inverse size of the molecule. And then the critical mass ratio, the lattice is also triangular, is 120 or 110, something like that. So it is smaller. And we still have the same picture of quantum transitions, so it's easier. We did not yet do the situation where the motion of heavy atoms is one-dimensional and also the motion of light atoms is one-dimensional. For that case, you expect a somewhat smaller mass ratio for the crystalline phase, but no quantum transitions. In 1D, what you will get is the 1D problem with one interaction constant. What you get is a continuous transformation of this gas phase correlations to crystalline phase. No quantum transition. But at the optical scale, you will have a very nice crystalline phase, yes? And the situation is such that here we expect a smaller mass ratio. We were quite reluctant to calculate that. But Fabian Essler told us that why don't you do that? Maybe it's somewhat smaller, maybe even for atoms, like let's say lithium and ytterbium, you can find that. Yes. Okay, that's what we have done, and that's what we are going to do. And I skipped a lot of interesting things, yes? And being long ago, what I used to do is to present conclusions. These are my conclusions, which say there was remarkable physics observed with these molecules and strongly interacting electrons. And then there is novel physics of positional stability in mixtures and possibilities to create new macroscopic quantum systems. And I think, yeah, I'm about to finish. Thank you for your patience.
In this last part, when you say the collisional stability didn't depend on the scattering length, does it depend on it being fermions, or could you do the same thing?
Would you be so kind to repeat your question a little bit slower?
Is really the question. Because the collisional stability, you had this term which depended on tunneling. Does it matter?
Yes. Yes, that's what I said. No, I have which consists of very heavy particle and very light one. It's important that those guys are fermions, because this provides you with exchange repulsion. If they were identical bosons, it would be the other way around. But who those guys are, it's not that important, yes? And for example, I can equally well think that those guys are bosons, and molecules are fermionic molecules. Then in the gas phase, they don't have a Bose-Einstein condensate, just have a fermionic molecular gas. But the issue with crystalline phase is more or less similar. Saying frankly, I did not do calculations for the case where those guys are bosons. But the picture is not that different in my view, yes? So, okay.
Because of course there are the atoms. There's R6 interactions.
Yes.
Are they just negligible because of energy or length scale?
Yes. John, of course, if I draw the bare interaction potential here, it includes everything.
Well, between the two molecules.
No, just a second. The bare interaction potential between atom and atom. It includes, of course, the repulsive core, the potential well, and the van der Waals state. At the end, the characteristic distance, the range of this potential is roughly speaking about 50 angstroms, 20 angstroms. Yes, it is small, right? And therefore, what I do, I use the Gottfried's approach, and at larger distances between particles, I replace this potential by the boundary condition. Yes? Then, you know what happens. Then, the exchange interaction is a function of this A, scattering length. If you want me to draw exactly the interaction potential between molecules at all distances, I did not go to smaller ones. If you wish the interaction potential here, this Galois potential. Because this is 1,000 angstroms. At 1,000 angstroms, all these van der Waals and etc. things are not important. This ordinary van der Waals between atoms, it's here, yes. And then I skip this part. And then this part is replaced by the boundary condition, yes. Of questions shows if everything is very clear and or nothing is clear. Yes. Ask me difficult questions. No. Are there difficult questions? No. Vic, you are used to ask difficult questions. Did I answer them?
Already asked many questions during the talk,
maybe? Yes, I quite tired already. Yes. Thank you.